This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. Are you ready for a field trip? Ken is your conceptual guide today, so hop on and let's go. Ken, this is a field trip of the mind. What do you mean by that, and what can we expect to learn?
Well, you know, I think that listeners of Imago Dei should get the very, very best. So yep. I'm going to take them on two field trips.
Ooh, two for one.
I'll bet these other RTB podcasts don't take their listeners on such dynamic podcasts. So one thing I really like about philosophy, Joe, is you can have intellectual thought experiments, mm-hmm. and they're fairly cheap. So Hugh Ross will be okay with that, right? He's always trying to keep us on the budget. But yeah, I want to talk about a couple intellectual field trips and kind of drawing us to this very powerful point, which is something we do a lot of in Imago Dei and RTB does. And that is that there are many meaningful realities that point to God. And in this show, it's information that points to God. So that'll be our focus.
All right. Sounds good. Do we need to pack a lunch for this?
You better pack a bag because it could be rather difficult. Okay. Now, I do want to tell you that when I was a kid, I liked going on field trips. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a lot of fun, maybe just to get out of the classroom, jump on a bus, and take us somewhere. And when I became a philosopher, I realized I could take a trip in my mind. I could.
You're not harking back to the 1960s and 70s.
Well,
are you?
I had a few friends and family members.
I think having a little help there.
See, the difference with me is I can remember the 60s. Some of my friends cannot.
Oh boy!
So let's talk about a intellectual field trip. I'm gonna call this first field trip leaving on a jet plane. Mm. Now those are. Maybe those are lyrics that might come from a particular song.
Indeed.
So here you go. Imagine that you're on a commercial jet and you're flying across the Pacific Ocean when catastrophe strikes.
Oh, no.
That's not something you want to encounter on a flight. The aircraft develops engine problems and the pilot is forced to crash land in the ocean. Think back a couple years ago when this one airplane went off radar,
right.
And
don't know where it went.
Couldn't find it. So, you know, planes crash, and they crash for different reasons. So imagine you're on this jet, jumbo jet. You have to crash into the ocean. The pilot is desperate. And I guess the bad news is that everybody dies. The good news is but you. You're the only one who survives. You drift in the ocean for a long time. And then somehow you make your way to what is the shore of a very small, apparently deserted island. Okay, that's a pretty dramatic field trip to take.
It's kind of like the movie Castaway.
Kind of like the movie Castaway. Pretty chaotic there.
Mm-hmm.
However, upon further exploration, you're shocked and exhilarated to discover the letters SOS written in the sand on the beach. Now, I want to stop there for a second. So you've gone through this horrific crash. You somehow, in God's providence, you've made it to the island. Everybody else is dead. You made it to the island, and you're completely fatigued. You're suffering from hypothermia, but you see in the sand, SOS. Now, at this point, I will call what I'd like to call a philosophical timeout. You know, when in a basketball game, a coach makes the capital letter T with his hands. Here, I want to do a little reflection, and I simply want to ask you the question, and I want our listeners to answer this question. Would any of you immediately think that the wind and the waves had formed the letters SOS in the sand through pure natural chance and accident? So you go through this horrific experience. You finally get to the shore. You're suffering from hypothermia. You're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And you look at the sands, and there is this nice Ken Samples printing. You guys have seen me print. It's like a font. They call it the Ken Samples font.
Yeah, right.
Nice SOS written in the sand. Not Fuzz Rana or Hugh Ross.
They're people, doctors,
people
after
would
all.
Say, that's, I don't know what caused that. It could have been an earthquake or something. I can pick on them. They're not on the show. Well, the answer to my question is, of course, no. No. You wouldn't think that the letters SOS written on the sand were caused purely by natural processes and therefore happened by accident. And the reason is that you would conclude that somebody had been there or was there or had been there and they had intentionally left this message. And you ask the question, why? Because the letters SOS constitute a universal distress signal. Save our ship. It's interesting to me. I like to watch these survival shows, you know, Alone or Dual Survival, where these guys go out into the woods, into the swamp or in the desert or in the jungle, and they have to, you know, find food and they have to create a place to sleep and they have to make fire by sticks, 10,000 BC. Wow. What I found interesting is the number three is the universal number of distress. So if you see three fires or you see three images, that's to communicate to people that there is distress. Of course, I would say in life we have a great deal of distress, and so we should call upon the three members of the Trinity to help us.
Wow.
Now, my point here in all of this is to illustrate that a code necessitates an intelligent messenger. Now, the SOS written on the sand is a very simple message, but it's distinct. And typically, when we see something human, some human artifact, some intelligently designed reality, it often looks very different than just kind of your normal, everyday physical object. And the point I want to make here is that we have, I think, an intuition that tells us that when we have a code or information, there's a mind on the other side.
Well, what you're looking for is a mechanism for how that, in this case, SOS appeared on the beach. And a naturalist, you know, he would ask the question, is there any natural mechanism other than an intelligent mechanism that could account for it?
So if Richard Dawkins was on a jumbo jet and the plane had to crash in the ocean, and Richard Dawkins was the only survivor and he crawled up to this island and saw SOS, do you think he would say that happened by accident, or do you think he would say there's an intelligent messenger behind this?
Well, of course, he would probably say what you just said, which is that there's probably some intelligent, but we're asking a deeper question than that, and that is a question that he doesn't want to accept. In other words, if maybe an analogous situation would be that he had a priori information that there could never have been an intelligent person on that beach or on that island, and now he's, in his view, has got to come up with some other explanation that he's not willing to accept.
Right. Now, I can appreciate that, but here's the point that I want our listeners to appreciate. You have an intuition. You have a natural intuition. And when you see the SOS, you would never draw any other conclusion than boom. I think that, Dave, when you go through life and you go through your learning and culturation and you suppress the truth in unrighteousness, yeah, to quote Paul. You put things on top of that, but the intuition when you see a code is there must be an intelligent mind. Yeah. I'd put it this way. A code equals information, and an information equals a messenger.
Right. I mean, I think you're right. I don't want to too quickly dismiss the concerns of an objective scientist who's trying to take into account lots of possibilities. And, you know, let's say, you know, we're looking at some code coming from a radio telescope that's looking.
In fact, here's my next quote. Astronomer Carl Sagan asserted that just one such coded message received from outer space would constitute clear evidence of the reality of extraterrestrial life.
Right, but the question is, what was that coded message? Was it just SOS?
Yeah.
Or was it some lengthy, if I recall, I think he's talking about if a string of prime numbers, for instance, that was somehow communicated in this message.
Well, let's take the next step. I'm asserting that you have an intuition. And I think
that's not always right, though. Our intuition isn't always
right, Dave. But what I'm saying is, when you go a step further, none of us would ever say, "Oh, well, now wait a second. Let's think about that." What I'm suggesting, Dave, is we have an intuition.
Sure.
And the intuition is when we see code, we think information, and we think there's a messenger on the other side. Now let's go a little further. Now, I do want to acknowledge that I first got this idea of SOS written on the sand in Peter Kraeff's book, Fundamentals of the Faith. But what Peter Kraeff didn't do is take you on a field trip. That's what I did, right? That's the fun part. Well, let's introduce a more complex code, the genetic code. Let's talk about DNA, right? Here's a quote from somebody you all know. It's Fuzz Rana. Dr. Rana says this. He says, DNA has the capacity to store an enormous quantity of information. 1 gram, now I'm not sure what a gram of DNA is.
It's a lot.
Is it a lot?
Well, when you consider each cell has a string of DNA, and that's pretty small, so to get a gram, you'd have to have lots of cells.
Okay. Well, here's the quote. DNA has the capacity to store an enormous quantity of information. 1 gram of DNA can house as much information as nearly 1 trillion CDs. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we move from SOS written in the sand to now what appears to be a much more complex code, right? DNA. Now, obviously, this intricate information system known as DNA, it dwarfs the complexity, these simple codes that we mention in our philosophical thought experiment, our field trip. And here's an interesting quote. Here's a quote from Bill Gates. I was watching a television program last night where there was a question about Henry Ford, and I said to my wife and my son that I think Henry Ford was kind of the Bill Gates of his time, but in a different way. There are people in history, you know, who kind of transform society and culture by the kind of work that they do. And I think the automobile may have been to the early 20th century what the computer is now. Anyway, that's an analogy. Here's what Bill Gates said. He said, human DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. Now, that question, right? And see, Dave, the reason I don't want to slow down is I want you to get the intuition. I want you to experience the field trip, and I want you to feel that bang. Then we can step back and we can begin to analyze. Suppose you landed on the beach and there was an Apple computer there. I mean, we could take the complexity from one point to another, but now I want to ask a question of our listeners. if relatively simple computer software requires the most intelligent, purposeful minds to create it, then what is the best explanation or the best explanatory hypothesis for the origin of the DNA code? You see, I want you, Dave, to feel that intuition, because I think that there's something buried inside us. And I'm not saying that it wouldn't be appropriate then to ask some deeper questions. But, you know, I think I know enough about Bill Gates to know that he doesn't hire dummies. He probably hires some of the best people possible. And what I mean by the best people, he probably hires people who have a lot of skill and a lot of background, maybe to produce a computer program. But he says human DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. Okay, so there is an intuition. Mm-hmm. I think most people carry this deep-seated intuition that there's something beyond the universe, namely that there's reason and purpose for the whole show. And I think that's what Paul the Apostle says, that all of us have a deep-seated intuition. And in one sense, we have to kind of work hard to kind of move away from that intuition. Now, Dave, I'm willing to entertain the idea that, well, maybe there are other explanations for that, but I'm trying to get you to get that intuition. Bang, you're there. What's your first thought? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when you're sleeping in on Saturday morning, you open the blind and you see the streets wet. You immediately think it rained. Your mind is searching for an explanation, right? Okay. I think there are signposts. I think there are pointers to God. And I think the idea of a code conveys information, which conveys a mind. Throw me your concern.
I was just trying to make the point that, you know, when you look at SOS, for instance, you start to ask the question, you posed the question, is it possible that there could be a natural explanation for this? Well, if it was only one letter, say an S, if the S was formed not by scratching in the sand, but say by logs, driftwood stacking up in such a way that it formed an S, it's conceivable that an S could be formed in that way by waves over a long period of time forming an S out of a stack of logs. So then you ask the question, well, what about an SOS? Now you've got three letters you have to. Well, I suppose you could figure out what's the probability that I'll get one letter. And then you can say, well, that would take a certain amount of time, maybe 1,000 years. And so now you have to ask the question, well, what about getting three? And that's, you know, probably, 1,000 to the cubed or something years for it to happen. So, you know, you can probably eliminate some of those possibilities by saying, well, it would take too long. The island wouldn't necessarily have even been here that many years ago. So what I'm just trying to call attention to is that if you look up in the sky and you see in the form of the clouds SOS, what would you say of that? Well, the clouds have all kinds of patterns. You can see chickens and you know, various
elephants
and things like that in the sky. But we know that clouds just come and go. And so the probability that there's an intelligent mind behind those, even though our intuition might say, woo, if it was not very practiced or very, very mature, would say, wow, there must be some intelligent source for this chicken that appears in the clouds in the sky.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. Our intuition is wrong there, and we learn through experience that, well, we wouldn't come to that conclusion about a cloud in the sky. But the SOS on the beach, that creates a little bit more of a problem.
And if you move from...
But then if you move to the next step, which is what you, of course, did... Looking at the DNA, what's the chances that the DNA is coming about through natural processes?
Okay.
And we know that, you know, so far, the naturalist scientist has been unable to come up with a mechanism for bringing that about in the first instance.
Okay, my point is nobody on Earth would think anything other than that SOS is an intelligent message. And if we move then to the DNA, it is incredibly powerful, right? Now, let's take another field trip. And again, Dave, I'm emphasizing intuitions here. This one is called All Aboard, right? Mm. So you take a train trip, and you're going to get on the Amtrak, for those of you who live outside of Southern California. We have a nice little train system here called the Amtrak, and you can jump on the train in Los Angeles, and you can take it down to San Diego. Dave and Joe, have you been down to the San Diego Zoo?
I have. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But okay. Not on a train.
Not on a train? Okay. Have you been on the Amtrak at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's say you get on the train and you're going down to San Diego and you fall asleep, which is a nice... my daughter commuted from a good distance to school, and for a while we thought about putting her on the train, because on the train you don't have to think about driving. Maybe you can do homework, or maybe you can rest. So you're on the train and you fall asleep, and when you awaken, you look at the train through the train window, and you see on the hillside in white shiny rocks arranged in such a way to spell out the message, "Welcome to San Diego." Okay? So think in your mind now, you're listening to this, you're on the train, you wake up, you look out the window, and on the side of the hill is spelled out, "Welcome to San Diego," in white shining rocks. Now here's the question. You're, of course, pleased and you're happy to see this message, right? But then there is a loudspeaker that comes on the that comes through the train, and it says, "Pay no heed to the apparent sign on the hillside." The Amtrak official explains that an earthquake, along with natural effects of rain, erosion, gravity, arranged the rocks on the hill. In other words, the arrangement of the rocks is caused by random chance and accident.
That's quite a message.
Now, again, I'm going to call a timeout. We could introduce Aristotle at this point. And so now the question is, you're sitting there and you see what appears to be a message written on the side of the hill. "Welcome to San Diego." Now, this is a difficult thing, but what if you accepted the idea that what appears to be a message actually is the result of simply a natural accident? It's rain, it's erosion, it's gravity. I would suggest to you at that point, if you accepted what the conductor said, then you couldn't believe on the basis of the rocks that you were in San Diego. In other words, if there's no message, there's no message without a mind. You see purely an arrangement of rocks, and you come to the conclusion. Now, your intuition, and again, we're back to this intuition. Your intuition is you see a message there. It's the arrangement of the rocks tells you you're welcome to San Diego. But now there's an explanation for that that says, no, it happened purely by natural processes. Well, I would assert that if it did happen by natural processes, then you couldn't believe on the basis of the rocks that you're in San Diego. Why? Because our intuition is there's no message without a mind. Okay. Now, again, I have to acknowledge where I got this idea. I was reading Richard Taylor's book, Metaphysics, and he provocatively lays out that question. So here is the idea. The idea is that our basic intuition is that when we see things that reflect code, we think there's information, and if there's information, there must be a messenger. But if somebody were to tell us that that happened purely by chance, then it would remove the idea of there being a message by taking a mind out of it. I think these kinds of things are what God created to utilize as pointers. And I think that there are many times where our intuition tells us one thing. Our good critical reasoning is very important, but I think that these often are things that God puts in place, and our intuition is more true than sometimes our worldview reflections upon that. Okay? You want a rebuttal, Dave?
No. I just think that there are situations where, you know, a person is going to examine various alternatives before he comes to the conclusion that it's information, that it's genuine information created by a mind. He may have a priori reasons, which we wouldn't necessarily accept, a naturalistic viewpoint, but I mean, that's what science is all about, is trying to come up with naturalistic explanations for everything that we see.
But what you said was interesting. What I drew from what you said was that our worldview colors the way we
Absolutely.
Look, the way we look at information.
But as a scientist, I make measurements and do research. In my case, it was astronomy. And I don't start thinking about, you know, supernatural explanations. I always think about natural explanations for the phenomenon that I'm seeing. Now, the problem that I as a Christian would have is that scientists never will allow the possibility that ultimately, in the end, when he can't come up with a naturalistic explanation, that there may be something else going on here.
And I guess my point is that I think our intuition tells us that SOS in the sand is to be understood as a universal distress signal, therefore it conveys information. But when we're hit with DNA and we still say there's no message behind it, I think that what that illustrates is that our worldview is clouding the way we think about these kinds of things.
I think I would agree with that, yeah.
Let's then take on another topic here, and it is a bit complicated, but I want to try to state it in as simple but hopefully clear and careful way. Philosophers talk about what we call a defeater, okay? A belief or a system of thought could have potential defeaters. My analogy is it's kind of like a boxing match. There's a way of defeating your opponent in a boxing match, and it's called a knockout, right? You knock down your opponent, and the referee jumps in and does a 10 count and says, you know, it's over. Is it possible that a belief system could be knocked out? Is it possible that a belief system could have a defeater? Well, I think Christianity has a potential defeater. I think Paul states it pretty clearly in 1 Corinthians 15, in other places, I think, and that is that if you could produce the body of Jesus, that would serve as a defeater for Christianity. So this question of can we knock something down? Well, Here is an idea that has been around a long time. It certainly is articulated by C.S. Lewis in his book Miracles, but I think to some degree it's reflected in Immanuel Kant, at least philosophers have found it in the German philosopher Immanuel Kant. And I suspect it probably even goes back to the philosopher Plato. And that is that if you have a mind and you have a brain, you have to be able to explain how those can serve as a reliable communicator of reason and rationality. Now, that's one way of putting it, but let me try to put it in another way. Let's suppose there's no God. And we're the product of blind, mechanistic, natural processes. The question then comes down to this. Can we trust our sensory organs? Our sensory organs would be our eyes, our ears, and our nose, and our cognitive faculties, that would be our brain and our mind. And from a naturalist perspective, naturalists have different ways of thinking about how mind came to be. You have emergent theories, you have reductionist theories, but here's my point. I think a naturalist would say your brain causes your mind. And when your brain dies at death, what happens to the mind? Psh, dead. Okay. Now the question is, if there's no mind behind the universe, how do we know that our sensory organs and our cognitive faculties are reliable to communicate truth and information? Okay, that's kind of the argument from reason that we've been looking at for many, many years, right? And so the idea is that how do we know when we have a code? And I would propose that I think that this is a potential knockout for naturalism. How do we know that if there's no mind? Now, if God exists, right? I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but here's the contrast. If God is an infinite eternal mind and he created people like you and me, he might decide to create creatures in his image, and we therefore have cognitive faculties and sensory organs that operate to discover the truth. But what if there is no mind behind the universe, right? And so you have the question of whether those sensory organs are reliable and whether the mind is reliable. And I would suggest to you, it's kind of like the rocks on the hill. If the rocks on the hill happen by, let's say, an earthquake, and then other naturalistic explanations like gravity and erosion and rain, and so they're thrown into that arrangement, so to speak, but it can't contain a message because there's no mind that arranged the rocks to put them into a sentence. I would suggest that there's an analogy there for the naturalistic situation where if everything is purely explainable by physics, chemistry, and biology, then it's purely a naturalistic process. So where do you have the protection or the guidance that you're actually getting true information? Mm-hmm. Now, I think that raises, in fact, there's a quotation here, if I may. Let me put it to you this way. What I find ironic is I think most naturalists, they never question the reliability of their sensory organs and cognitive faculties. They take it as an assumption that they're seeing what's real and they're having thoughts that correspond to the nature of reality. And here's a quotation, and I think it's a good one and a reflective one. It's Oxford mathematician, Christian thinker John Lennox. He asked this question about naturalism. He says, either human intelligence ultimately owes its origin to mindless matter, or there is a creator. Strange, is it not, that some people claim that it is their intelligence that leads them to prefer the first to the second? Now, I don't want to move across that too quickly, because if you don't have that quote in front of you, you may not feel the force of what Lennox said. So let me restate it, and then I'll outline it for you. Lennox says, either human intelligence ultimately owes its origin to mindless matter, or there is a creator. Strange, is it not, that some people claim that it is their intelligence that leads them to prefer the first to the second. Mm-hmm. So where does human intelligence come? It comes, one, from mindless matter, or two, it comes from an ultimate mind, God. But the naturalist says their intelligence pushes them to conclude mindless matter over intelligence.
Right.
This is that question. Now, if the world's intelligibility, if information is detected through human reason, that makes sense if there's a God. It makes sense. How do you make sense of sense? My thought in reading atheists and reading about the worldview of naturalism, I think atheists struggle to explain three basic things. I think they struggle to explain, number one, reason and rationality. They realize you can't depart from that because if we can't trust reason and rationality, then there's no good reason to be an atheist or a Christian. So we have to have reason and rationality. And atheists think that the evidence against God is on their side. So I think they struggle to explain reason and rationality. And I'm going to go into more of that in just a minute. I also think that they struggle to explain meaning and purpose. But people can't live without meaning and purpose. Psychologist Viktor Frankl, the famous 20th century survivor of the Holocaust, said that what people need in life is hope. They need purpose. I think the atheist struggles to explain reason. I think they struggle to explain meaning. And lastly, I think they struggle to explain morality. Right. Now, here's C.S. Lewis. This is a quote from a Christian reply to Professor Price. He says, if naturalism were true, then all thoughts, whatever, would be wholly the result of irrational causes. Then he says it cuts its own throat. If naturalism were true, then all thoughts, whatever, would be wholly the result of irrational causes. It cuts its own throat. That is, if the rocks on the hill are purely the product of physics, then there's no good reason to believe that the arrangement of those rocks actually conveys information about where you are, namely, you're in San Diego. So the analogy is, and I think it's an interesting analogy, if our brain and our sensory organs are kind of like the rocks on the hill, they're purely explained by natural processes, then what makes us think that we can actually get independent information? That's another way of thinking about the argument from reason. Now, let me put it into another context here. There's a philosopher that I've been reading a good bit of time. His name is Richard Pertil, Dr. Pertil, who passed away in 2016, I'm sad to say. Pertil was a Roman Catholic, and I say that because some Catholics really like C.S. Lewis. In fact, I find that to be a bit puzzling about Lewis. I find Reformed thinkers who like C.S. Lewis. I find Lutheran thinkers who like C.S. Lewis. Anglican, well, I guess I shouldn't be surprised because Lewis was himself an Anglican. But I find Pentecostals like Dave Rogstad who like C.S. Lewis, which I think is interesting because sometimes we gravitate toward people or away from people. And part of it is our own theological kind of tradition. For example, some Calvinists don't like Lewis because they don't think he's presuppositional enough, right? Well, here's what Richard Pertil, a Catholic, says. He says, one way of getting a preliminary insight into C.S. Lewis's argument from reason is to ask whether nature is the product of mind or mind is the product of nature. If God created nature, as Christians believe, then nature is understandable by reason because it's the product of reason. Now, let me again put this into kind of a comparison for you because, quite frankly, I think the argument from reason is easily obscured. I think it's complex. I think it's abstract. And I don't think people sometimes feel the force of it. And sometimes I lose the force of it. And I have to kind of come back to it. So now the question is nature the product of mind or is mind the product of nature? Well, let's assume that nature is the product of mind. Let's assume that a divine mind created the cosmos. Okay? God made nature. Well, then I don't think we should be surprised that reason can be used to explore the cosmos because reason is a product of the creation. Now, the reason I mention this is that Paul Davies, a leading physicist and cosmologist of our time. If I could kind of put it into my own words, I think Davies has kind of conveyed that maybe the thing that kind of keeps him up at night is not just that the universe seems to be intelligible, but that human beings contract the intelligibility of the cosmos. Now, I think Davies is a very insightful person, and I admire him. I admire him not just because sometimes he seems to believe what I believe, which is a nice thing, right? It's always nice when people, when you think, hey, that person kind of agrees with me. What I think is interesting about Davies is he's not afraid to disagree with his secular colleagues. And he thinks there is some intelligibility to the universe, and he's puzzled why human beings could track that intelligibility. It's not just that the universe seems to be fine-tuned, but we're able to detect the fine-tuning. And I've been on blog sites where atheists just pillar him because he's saying, maybe our explanation isn't perfect, you know? Now, I think that Davies is at least an agnostic. I'm not suggesting that he is a theist or even a deist. But here is, again, the idea that if God created the world and if Christianity is true, then we should expect to discover that not only is the universe designed, but we can track the intelligibility of the design. I think, on the other hand, if there's no mind behind the universe, then I think we should be shocked. If there's no mind behind the universe and we find seemingly design or fine-tuning, maybe apparent design, obviously if there's no mind behind the universe, it's apparent design rather than real design. But then there's this amazing thing that this product called the brain, which produces the mind, which is reducible to physics, chemistry, and biology, somehow has the ability to understand the universe based upon reason. And again, I'm back to this basic intuition of rocks on a hillside. And back to codes. Now, let me just kind of sum up here. I like what Greg Gansel says. Greg Gansel is a Christian philosopher. He teaches at Biola. He says this. He says, the fact that the universe is made by a mind for reasons leads us to expect that it can be grasped rationally. It makes sense that stable laws would allow predictions be made and inference be drawn. Gansel continues. He says, a naturalist universe, however, would not have to be susceptible to rational investigation. It fits perfectly well with a naturalist universe that it be wildly chaotic. Of course, being susceptible to rational investigation is not incompatible with a universe without God, but the theory that God does not exist allows the universe to exhibit any one of a wide variety of descriptions as far as order is concerned. Why is the universe susceptible to rational investigation? I would propose to you that that makes perfect sense in a theistic universe. It is very odd in an atheist universe. So, and I think it does come down to intuition. Hmm. Now, one more quote. I again come back to Paul Davies. This is a popular article. He wrote in New York Times, 11/24/07. It's entitled Taking Science on Faith. Davies says this, over the years, I have often asked my physicist colleagues why the laws of physics are what they are. The answers vary from that's not a scientific question to nobody knows. The favorite reply is there is no reason that they are what they are. They just are. And he then says this, the idea that the laws exist reasonlessly, I like that word, Joe. I'm going to use that in my writings. The idea that the laws exist reasonlessly is deeply anti-rational. After all, the very essence of a scientific explanation of some phenomenon is that the world is ordered logically and that there are reasons things are as they are. If one traces these reasons all the way back to the bedrock of reality, the laws of physics, only to find that reason then deserts us, it makes a mockery of science. I think that information points to God. I think that we have an intuition that is built into us that when we see a code, we ask, what is the message in that? We don't assume that it's purely naturalistic processes. And I think there is a potential knockout for naturalism. And that is, and here's the irony that I brought up many times. I've talked to Hugh and Fuzz and Dave and Jeff and AJ about this issue. As a philosopher, I find it very ironic that the scientific enterprise recruits the brightest and the best individuals, sends them to the finest schools, gives them the best possible training intellectually. And you can't help but think that in that enterprise, there is kind of a snobbishness. Of course, it may only be equaled by the snobbishness that exists in philosophical circles. But here's my point, and I know some of the people listening to our program are scientists and engineers. They're math nerds. So the scientific enterprise recruits the best high school students, sends them to the best colleges, gives them the most specialized training at the best graduate schools in the world. And yet then they join an enterprise where the consensus is that there's no mind or rationality behind the universe. I think that's a deep irony. That is science. Science wants robust thinkers. It wants rational thinkers. It plays on reason, rationality, and being smart, being sharp, to then adopt a philosophy that says, but there's none of that behind the universe. I think, David, that's an irony.
Could be. Let me ask you a question. You've emphasized a number of times that our intuition tells us that when we see an SOS, that there's a mind behind it.
Yes.
Intelligence behind it. Do you think, when you say it's an intuition, do you think that it's there it's inherently there, or is it learned?
Well, I would say, I think that there is a built-in intuition by being made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. Now, by saying that, now let me go back to your cloud example. It's not that it can't be wrong, because I've seen clouds that look like they look like UFO ships. I've seen clouds that look like all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So when you look at something and you think, wow, that looks like this. Of course, you could be kind of reading into it. I think when you look at clouds, I think it's not so much they're looking as something as much as you're kind of reading into it, so to speak. I think, Dave, we have a basic intuition about things like truth and reality. The problem is they can be mistaken. Your example of the cloud would be one of them. But I also think that our worldview can get in the way of that mm-hmm. basic intuition. And I do think that's the way the mind works. When I'm sleeping in on Saturday morning, I open the blind and I peek out and I see the street wet. I immediately, it's almost not something I choose to do. I immediately draw an explanatory hypothesis. I think that's the way we're wired. The danger, as you say, potential danger, is that we could be wrong. But I actually would say, Dave, I think sometimes our worldview can contaminate that basic divine intuition. And I think the reason God creates us that way, this is kind of an irony that I'm taking this position and you're taking a different one. I actually think that it doesn't have anything to do with our education level. I think God has made us in such a way that there are pointers to him, and it doesn't matter if you have a PhD or an advanced degree, you have this inner intuition. The criticism, and I think it's a fair one, under certain conditions it could be mistaken, but I still think it's there. I think it's similar to our own sense of morality. I think hurting a child is just, I don't think it's so much a rational process. I think the idea that you would hurt a child, sexually molest the child, or that you would physically hurt the child, I think there is this moral intuition. You can attribute it to acculturation. You can say, well, that's just our evolutionary wiring. But again, I think, Dave, that there's worldview, and sometimes worldview can enhance. It's like a pair of glasses, right? A good pair of glasses brings thing into focus. Wow, this is good. I can see this. But I think another pair of glasses can kind of distort it. So I think there is an intuition, and I think that intuition is a pointer to God. It could be mistaken, and I'm not criticizing tough-minded scientists. You know me. I teach logic. I teach rationality. I'm always emphasizing reading and thinking. And I think the biggest problem in the evangelical church today is not a lack of prayer or Bible study. I don't think we have good schools. I don't think our churches are schools. But I think there's an intuition. And I think that intuition needs explanation. I don't know if you want to ask a further question.
I can readily agree that morally, I think that we have a moral sense built into us, part of the image of God, and that moral sense, there's guilt when, you know, you don't have to teach a child to do something wrong. They lie. And they lie because they get caught doing something, and there's guilt, and they want to cover that guilt. And so you can see that as just a little child. The other aspect, which is more, maybe in general, you could call it pattern recognition, the ability to see patterns and see that there's significance to a pattern. You see an SOS, that's a pattern. You recognize that that pattern is not a random pattern, but has some information in it. To me, that seems more a learned process than an inherent process. But you know, obviously, reason is something that comes, you know, it's from the mind of God, and so pattern recognition is part of that mind that he's put within us. But there are a lot of things that we know intuitively, and there's a lot of things that we know through experience and through learning. I mean, it's like an ant. An ant knows, a better example, I was just watching a nature film the other day, and this little animal, it's a lizard, comes out of an egg, and it pops its head up against, and it's immediately alert and knows a lot of things, and there's snakes that are going to come and get these and eat it, and as soon as it sees the snake, it runs for the rocks. Well, how does it know all of this stuff just coming out of the egg? I mean, there's got to be stuff built in to this animal. Well, we have a lot of built-in stuff, but we have a lot of stuff that we learn. And I think human beings are probably more that way than maybe any animal in the world, in the kingdom, animal kingdom, in that we have much less wired in and much more gained through learning and through a process of development. And so now the question is, well, you've used the word intuitive. And I'm just wondering how much of that is learned versus whether it's built in the same way, say, a moral issue is built in.
And I think it's similar. I think logic and math is a lot intuition. I think when you study math, you study logic, you see it. And I think that in a sense, I think the irony is, I don't think there's a person on the planet who would crash into the ocean, land on a apparently deserted island, see SOS, and then ask philosophical questions about the origin. I think they'd immediately look at it. And I think the irony, Dave, is you have the DNA code, which is overwhelmingly complex and contains enormous information, and yet people don't want to see that as a pointer to God. And I think at that point, the question should be asked, is my worldview getting in the way?
Yeah, I fully agree with that. Although I would just take issue with, if the person never knew that SOS hadn't had that information in his brain, had never learned that SOS, he wouldn't even have noticed the SOS.
Yeah, but once you see something and recognize it as a code, you never draw the information it happened by chance, is my point. Joseph?
All right. Great stuff. Thank you for that. It's been quite a field trip. I'm hungry now, hey. So I'm ready to check in.
So in these other RTB podcasts, do they take you on field trips?
Not really. We go into the scientific bookstore and check out some big books.
Well, that's good, too. I like that.
Yes, it is. It's all good stuff. Appreciate that. Thank you, Ken and Dave, both. All right. For Ken and Dave, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.